Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone. Tonight, our guest speaker will be Columbine Robinson, and she will be giving a Way-Seeking Mind talk. So I think most of you know Columbine. Let me spotlight Columbine. Columbine, how long have you been coming to Canando for?
I think since about 2013, maybe.
Great. Well, so she's been with us for a long time. Well, thank you, Columbine. Looking forward to hear your talk. Welcome.
Thank you. Before I get started, I see many of my family members on this call, so I'm very lucky to have that. Especially my grandma is on this call. We recently found out that a longtime family friend died, and it's very hard right now because, you know, we're all unable to see each other, and the fact that we haven't physically gotten together in so long is very challenging. I hope we can have some peace on that. So let me get started on my talk. I think my practice probably started back in the 70s before I was born. My dad told me that he had seen a flyer at UCSC by a man, Covantino, and he was curious. Growing up, my dad would bring me to Berkeley Zen Center, and my mom sometimes would bring me to San Francisco Zen Center. In fact, my dad and stepmom got married at Berkeley Zen Center. When I was at my mom's house, we chanted the five contemplations before every meal. When we went camping, she taught me how to clean my bowl with water and drink it, Oryoki style. Always thought the contradictory koans were silly and sitting and doing nothing was somehow valuable, but I completely didn't understand it. When I was around 3 years old, my mom decided that a nuclear family was unsatisfying. My parents had very different parenting styles, and bouncing between them, I think, made life confusing and unstable. I was constantly having to adapt to different environments. Additionally, my mom's mood swings kept me alert for adjustments. My dad lived in Albany, which is where Bonnie used to go, where I went to school. But my mom moved around Oakland and San Francisco. Sometimes people say, oh, you are an only child. You must have been spoiled. I don't know if I agree with this. One thing I do think about being an only child is that maybe there is more a sense of aloneness and self-centeredness and ultimately separation. My mom is very expressive, whereas my dad is less so. I think as a child, I may have misinterpreted this expressiveness as caring. Even now, I struggle to define what caring is. My mom treated me as an equal and a pair. When she got remarried, I felt tossed to the side. It occurred to me recently that my only perception of love was a conditional love. Perhaps this was a misunderstanding. I think this explains why I didn't need much discipline as a child. If my parents showed me the slightest sign of disapprovement, I took it very seriously. This manifested into an effort to be perfect. I wanted to be easy. This, coupled with a developing depression, made me want to be non-existent. I've always loved math and puzzles. My dad used to take me to family math night when I was super young. And a nerdy fact, I even went to math camp when I was about 10. My stepmom figured I loved the objectiveness of math in a world that I found confusing. My entire family is made up of poets and artists, and actually I am the only scientist. But my stepmom was right. I had a really hard time not seeing the world as black and white. This caused some problems for me, though. As I became an adult, I slipped into a depression and self-destructive behavior. The group of friends I had in high school had troubled relationships with their parents like me. I think we were all fairly angry at our circumstance, but didn't really know how to resolve it. In Buddhism, we learn not to label things as good or bad, just take them for what they are. This allows one to soften the edges of this black and white filter of the world. It reminds me of my favorite English teacher in eighth grade, who always encouraged me in my creative writing. He had us write about our mixed emotions. Unfortunately, once I entered high school, my English teachers thought my writing ability was not nearly up to par. This is also around the time that youth starts to explore the idea of good versus evil, which is a very simplistic view of the world. But it's too simple. Even as I continued my higher education in physics, I realized that humans' understanding of the world was constantly changing and argued over, not so straightforward or black and white. I remember thinking Buddhism was interesting, but I was always so busy in high school and college. I was constantly under stress to make good grades. At the time, I felt religion was a bit too sugar-coated or inauthentic. I remember going with my friend to a church and having a terrible experience. In college, I felt very strongly that I didn't have the time to devote to learning more about Buddhism, and I didn't want to half do it. In 2008, I moved to the South Bay to start my first job. At that company, I was under a tremendous amount of pressure. There was a culture of consumerism that came with this. I remember always wanting material things, a brown dress, a gold bracelet, that red lipstick. When I would get it, I was happy, and then I would move on to the next thing I wanted. It was this constant turnover that never felt ultimately satisfying. Eventually, the stress and pressure caused me to get to a very unhealthy point. I was scared, and I felt very lost. This is when I started coming to Canando. The only way I knew how to deal with stress was to starve my brain. Meditation offers a way to quiet the mind without harming the body. In the past, I had felt that philosophy, art, religion were annoyingly subjective. Less resonated with me specifically because he had lived in a high-tech world. Less was the embodiment of the two worlds I lived in that felt so separate. There were so many nights I would drive home from Canando on a Wednesday night after lecture, feeling elated and yet grounded in Les's words that were like gold to me. Even in the lectures that felt quite familiar, I felt there was great importance and value in Les reminding us on a weekly basis that we needed to care for things, have good effort, and that we were part of a bigger whole. In many ways, we are our own teachers in Buddhism. It is really a practice of having a wide view of what is happening without delusions, where it stems from, and or what it leads to. A huge component to my self-harm was a buildup of pressure so that I could release that pressure. This was addictive, and I think many people can relate to this. This is like a scratch we have. It can feel so good to scratch it, and then when we look down and see that we've got a bloody foot, we think, oh no. What can I do differently? Is there an alternative to scratching? What if we try not scratching? Does the itch go away? But Buddhism doesn't shame us like other religions. It lets us teach ourselves through awareness. I've never been one to seek fame. As a child, I watched my mom suffer great depression because she was not recognized for her poetry. Even so, I did have a lot of pride and ego, especially in my career. Dropping ego was a huge revelation for me. I felt a sense of relief when I knew I was not solely responsible for the outcomes specifically at work. It also helped me understand that we all work together. Dropping ego also helped tremendously with my striving to be perfect. If there was no me, what was there to be perfect? We learn in Buddhism that we are inherently perfect, and I suppose this is unconditional love. Less always installs a sense of confidence in us. I used to struggle a lot with a feeling of separateness from people who were egomaniacs. I think I still do, but it has lessened a lot, and maybe not having a connection is okay. This confidence also allows me to continually try my best to the best of my ability at work, even if I'm not recognized. I remember when I first started coming to Canandaigua, I really didn't like sitting next to someone else. Now I love sitting right in the middle of people. Well, maybe not now, but eventually. Sometimes the person next to you will squirm or let out a long sigh, and I imagine taking their hand to say, yes, this is hard, I'm struggling with you. When I first started working in the Silicon Valley, I went home quite a bit to be with my parents. I had a really hard time finding people that I could have intellectually stimulating conversations with. I especially love the opportunity that Les gives us at the end of every lecture for people to ask questions. Canada is full of people that I can have deep conversations with, and this brings me great joy. I also enjoy watching people over the years and seeing them grow. Some people whose anger is quite evident, I have witnessed this lesson over the years. I also joined a group called Wake Up, which follows Thich Nhat Hanh. I remember I really loved the 5 mindfulness trainings, especially the ones about listening from the heart, also the meaning of true love. In this, it is explained that true love is not lust or sexualized. This really resonated with me because I think there's an underlying feeling that I cannot be loved without being a certain way. I've always been a pretty impatient person and never really enjoyed cleaning, but now I find myself getting lost in cleaning. I find it very calming. As a child, I did get lost in my pottery artwork, but found clean somewhat fruitless. It's funny, a story about my dad. I remember when it was time to go to college, I threw everything I had in the back of our tiny Ford Aspire, and of course it wouldn't fit. My dad took everything out and packed the car like a Tetris puzzle and magically was able to fit everything. My dad has always been very deliberate and disciplined like that, and I am reminded of that in Les. I remember one time going for a run in the cold rain. I think Les had just given a lecture about facing into the storm. I remember really feeling the rain on me and not feeling like it was a bad thing. I was really able to be in the moment with those sensations. It's interesting because I studied karate for 6 years, and I remember how we were always taught that if someone attacked you, it's best to move into them rather than to retreat. I've noticed a certain flow that life can take on when you are like the bamboo in the wind. I know this is silly, but the other day I needed to call my credit card company, and I knew I would be put on hold for quite some time. I was doing chores around the house, and I needed to take out the trash. I could have taken the phone with me, but I just walked away. The second I got back, an operator came on. Brilliant. I've always been aware that many things can be overcome mentally, such as running a marathon. I was aware of how powerful my mind was over my physical state, such as anxiety causing panic attacks. But Buddhism has brought this to a new level. There's a common saying, it's all mental, when referring to overcoming seemingly physically impossible goals. But in Buddhism, we learn that everything is an illusion. So not only our thoughts, but everything. I think when you're first presented with this, it's a very strange notion. It feels very foreign and outlandish. But if you let it marinate in your brain in conjunction with meditation practice, it starts to grow roots. Although I don't think it's really possible to articulate in words. You just have to do it. One way in which I struggle with attachment is not trying new things. I find a lot of comfort in the known. So for me, trying new things is a way I can practice non-attachment. I remember Bonnie one time telling me to take a different route home, just to do something out of the routine. I do think this helps a lot with being present in the moment. I am also attached to memories, nostalgia. I still am, but I notice I hold on less tightly. Society pushes us to fill our schedules, our families, our houses, etc. Of course, in high school and college, I plaster my walls with posters and pictures. My room now literally has my bed, a small table, and an alarm clock. I remember once a friend asked me, "Did you just move here?" I embarrassingly responded, "No, I've lived here for years, but now I take a lot of pride in how simple it is." The one thing that will always stick with me is a story that Les told about how he found some sticky stuff in the rug one day, and rather than scrub hard, he put a little bit of water on it and let it sit for a while and came back and it came right off. This is not only a hugely practical piece of advice, but also metaphorical. Sometimes people are not ready to have a certain conversation when you want to have it, and you have to respect that and try again at a later time. In fact, this is much like our sitting practice. Sometimes we come to sit and we cannot keep our mind from jumping around. This is okay. We can try again tomorrow. I am happy to report that I am in a less stressful company now. While it may not be as satisfying in a lot of ways, it allows me to focus on my daily practice. One thing I really do love is to go on hikes. I used to run a lot, but I find hiking more enjoyable. The place where I go is filled with people. It's funny because everyone complains about that, but I love that. I found that going on long bike rides often got very lonely, and being cramped into a gym was a bit too close. But hiking is perfect. I heard about a study where they took babies and they would face them towards each other. The babies were rocked in sync with each other, and this formed a connection, and they would then volunteer to help each other. I think there is something great about walking in sync with others without talking. While I may not be part of a group in the formal sense, we are literally together, and we can experience the time together. This is also true of Canando. I love the intimacy of being with other people without having to say anything. As a child, boredom was something I struggled with quite a bit. Now thinking about it, it's quite hard to describe what exactly boredom is. Somehow there's an unmet need. In college, I spent a summer in New York. I was extremely lonely and felt intellectually unstimulated. I relapsed into self-destructive habits. Through the practice, I have found this painful boredom doesn't come up much. Les makes a point to emphasize that every moment is important and fleeting. Les also emphasizes taking care of things. When one does not take care of things, I think it's easier to become bored and feel pointless. But if one has a sense of self-worth, not ego, to care for things, we have a purpose. When discussing Suzuki's book, Branching Streams, we discussed about the earwig and how this symbolizes our annoyances. Even if we kill one, there will always be one to replace it. And it's true. I sometimes watch my thoughts and find it incredibly ridiculous when my first thought that enters my mind when I wake up is, what do I have to be annoyed about today? But that's the thing I find most helpful about Buddhism, is to be very aware of my thoughts. I always ask myself, why do I feel so strongly about this thing that just happens? I think it gives a little bit of space from getting swept up in the emotion, which I tend to do. So I think being able to constantly question is good. I am also much more aware of my anxieties, which helps relax them. Sometimes I can feel the tides of my anxiety rise and I can take a deep breath. Or I can feel the tides of my depression come in, and I can reassure myself that it will pass. I remember for a long time feeling a sense of painful loneliness. I remember in high school telling my therapist about a time where I was right next to my boyfriend and yet felt completely alone. I have noticed that sometimes I can feel more alone when I am with other people than when I am alone. I think part of it of this is that there is an expectation that when you are with other people, there will be a connection. But when that connection is not there, it's very obvious. Versus when you are alone, there's no expectation to feel connected. But I've noticed through the practice, this feeling of painful loneliness has almost completely gone away. And I attribute this to knowing that we are all part of one. If I make it seem like my meditation practice has solved all my problems, that is certainly not the case. A lot of life is luck. I left one toxic job only to find myself in another. My health worsened to the point where sitting meditation was unbearable. I think my first calling to Canando came from a need to be saved, and yet I returned at a time in which my environment was much more forgiving. I am very grateful for this fortune.
Thank you, Columbine.
Thank you.
So, we'll take questions now. I see Chris. Go ahead, Chris.
I was just Gasha. I didn't have a question, but I will say thank you very much, Columbine. And so good to hear you speak. And thank you for offering. And we have a common physics and kind of background. And so I definitely want to have coffee with you sometime when we're allowed to do that. Thank you.
Yes, I would enjoy that very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Laura, did you have your hand up?
Dave, okay. I'm going to spotlight you, Dave. Go for it.
Yeah, so I think you're the first person I've ever heard say, Columbine, that you grew up with parents who were already into Zen. I'm not sure if I know anyone else who comes from a family background like that, but I'm just wondering if you feel you have, I mean, it's always hard to say, you know, what if your life had been different? How would it compare to the way it was? But do you feel that your entry into Zen practice was fundamentally different from that of people who come to it from, say, a Christian background or a Jewish background or maybe a non-religious background?
It's like you said, it's hard to say because I don't have the experience of being very connected to a different religion. I think maybe it's possible that it comes more naturally because I've been growing up my whole life being told these ideas, and definitely as a child I thought it was weird and thought my parents were strange humans. I think probably it's been kind of in my mind for such a long time, it feels more natural maybe. But I think that's probably true of Americans, right? I mean, if you go back in Japan, maybe there would be more people whose parents also practice Buddhism. There's so many different versions of Buddhism and life and lineage. So everyone kind of has their own unique experience. It's an interesting question. If I hadn't been raised with Buddhist parents, if I would have found my way to Buddhism, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess I remember when I first started coming to Canando and looking at myself in the mirror one morning and saying, well, are you a Buddhist yet? The answer that came back was, well, I guess I feel like I've always been a Buddhist. I just didn't know what to call it.
Yeah, I think sometimes people who have such a break from their, like, say they were brought up Christian, it's more like they have to try harder to kind of get into Buddhism. Like they want to learn all about it and do everything. Maybe for me it was less like that because it was always kind of part of my life. So I didn't feel it was like earth shattering. It just flowed naturally, I guess.
Any other questions or comments?
I have a question. Megan.
Hi, Megan.
Hi. Just for Columbine, it seems like what has happened for you, and maybe it's part of life and part of Buddhism, is that you're more comfortable with yourself, that you seem less, you know, like, well, I'm cleaning, that's fine. I get that sense. And do you think that came out of being a Buddhist?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think part of it is just sort of maturing and getting older. It's hard to decouple that with Buddhism. But I think that a lot of the practice has built up patience and trying to understand, try to understand different people's viewpoints so that there's not so much conflict, maybe. And there's a sense of maybe respect, like, even if I'm not gonna understand your viewpoint, it's still your viewpoint. And less, I think also a big thing with Buddhism is just acceptance and not fighting things. So if you don't agree with somebody, maybe when I was younger, I would get real angry and riled up. But now it seems like not really where I want to focus my energy, because fighting doesn't really get us anywhere. Yeah, actually, but to point out, you know, Bonnie gave a talk recently, and I think that's what made me want to give a talk of my own. And it is funny because we grew up very, very close together. Just literally, she said she went to the bookstore in Albany, which we may have even seen each other. In fact, we had different upbringings. But and we had a lot of similarities as well. You know, we both went to a UC school. We both are technical women in science, which is unusual. So, yeah.
I'll ask a question since you met. So I've known you for a while, Columbine. Like, I think you were one of the first people I saw when I started coming to Canada. Not the first time, but soon after that. And at first you were very quiet, and then you've been showing up more and like leading Med and Life discussions a few times. And as long as you've been coming to Canada, this is your first time actually really speaking in a public setting like this public. And you also shared a lot of personal information, like the struggle you've been through and your development. So I'm just wondering, how does that feel for you? Like to, be able to openly talk about your past and your learnings, and like, how's it feeling?
So, like, I remember when I first started coming, having people do their way seeking mind talks, and I thought, oh, you know, that I love to hear people's stories. You learn so much depth about them, and I want to share my own story. And then after a while, I thought, well, you know, and now that I've, you know, learned and grown so much, I really don't have a whole lot to say, because that's sort of the whole thing with Buddhism, is that, you know, I shouldn't indulge in my, you know, ego and this is me, this is my story, yada, yada. And I, this about 2 years ago, it was at the holiday party. I think I just said something to Les, like, oh yeah, I love people's way-seeking mind talks. And he immediately was like, well, when are you going to give one? And I thought, oh God, I don't know about that one. So yeah, I just sort of put that off for a very long time. And then in hearing yours recently, I thought, oh, well, I really want to give one. And so you told me, well, why don't you try writing it? And I thought, okay, yeah, that's a good idea, because gosh, if I just try to make it up as I go, that might be a disaster. And I really enjoyed it. I've been listening to some memoirs, and it's just like a style of writing. And I enjoyed writing. I don't really write that much. I know you like to write a lot and you're very into it, but I've never been one to want to, you know, it's funny because as a child, I think I used to keep a diary from time to time. And then every once in a while, I would go back to read the diary and think, oh my gosh, I'm such an idiot. Why did I write this? Like, I just felt so embarrassed about what I wrote. So I felt it was sort of pointless.
Thank you. And one thing related to what you said, like, well, I don't want it to be all about my story, right? It's supposed to be about something bigger. My first teacher, Natalie, who, as you know, teaches writing, told me that you can access that bigger life, but it's through the details of your individual life, right? But in order to do that, you have to go very, very deep. Like, you can't just skim the surface of life. And that's kind of what I've found in my practice, is like, if I go deeper into the details of my life, I find what's actually relevant to everyone, like our shared humanity. So I don't know if that resonates for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, yeah, my experience of the Silicon Valley and getting kind of, I think it's a very similar experience of getting kind of wrapped up in the materialism and ego of, I mean, if you walk into any company in the Silicon Valley, you know, it's full of men with like big egos. I think everyone kind of has that experience. I think everyone at some point in their life feels like, well, gosh, that's not really me, or that's not really satisfying. And so it doesn't really matter what the specifics are, but I think the common thread is that people want something more satisfying, and it doesn't necessarily have to be Buddhism. It can be anything spiritual and a connection with other people, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to, Nick has a question, so. Go ahead, Nick. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Nick. Hi, Columbine. Thank you so much for giving a talk that it just sounds like it came straight from your heart, and it's really laying everything out on the line like that. There was one thing that you mentioned in your talk that I'm curious to kind of hear a little bit more about. You're really vulnerable to talk about how you've managed and worked through depression. And I think right now, especially, a lot of people come to Zen practice thinking that it's like a system of treatment for depression, or, you know, not to be grossly oversimplistic, but they think it's kind of like a magic pill for treating depression. Mm. And I know I've definitely had a few friends and colleagues approach me saying, oh, I know you're really involved with Zen, and, you know, I've just been really down lately, or, you know, I've been struggling with depression. I think I want to give it a try, you know, something kind of like that. And I think it's a very valid reason for someone to kind of have a gateway into the practice. But I kind of sense from your talk that this practice has been anything but a magic bullet or a magic pill for treating this really difficult thing that's part of the human condition. So I'm wondering if you might be comfortable saying a few more words about that.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting to talk about now, because actually there was a fresh air yesterday about the psychedelic study for depression, and they were talking about, you know, common antidepressants. you know, I mean, some people, I think, may say like, oh, I've been feeling down, and it's not clinical depression. But I think there's a spectrum within clinically depressed and just sort of environmentally feeling down. I can say for myself, so my dad is a very strong believer, and my stepmom as well, in therapy, in talk therapy. And I was in therapy for a long time as a child, and I think it helped me a lot. But I think there were some limits. And additionally, like, you could say the same thing for antidepressants. They can change your life, but they don't fix everything. So that's why they usually say, you know, you need to have medication and therapy together. My mom is more of a believer in Buddhism and feels that therapy is not the solution. You can talk about, you know, oh, this happened, that happened all day long, and it never really fixes it. And so she's more of the believer that Buddhism will kind of be the solution to your problems. So all I can say is I can speak from myself. I think basically everything helps. I think that Buddhism was able to give me some peace that therapy couldn't. So I think in a way my mom and my dad are both right. There's value in Buddhism for helping depression as well as therapy. I don't think there's really a magic pill or magic solution for anything in life. I mean, you know, my stepmom has always been the one to say, like, there's no free lunch. Like, if you think something's incredible, it's probably not. You're going to find out that it's not what you think it is. So anything that's worth it in life, you have to work hard for. So, but I do think that Buddhism has been able to meet a need that cannot be met by other means.
Great. Thank you so much, Columbine.
Thank you. I see Travis.
Thank you. Hey.
Hey, Travis.
Hey, Columbine. Hi, Columbine. I've been in and out with communication problems, but thank you for your talk. Yeah, I think, you know, what you're saying about depression really resonates with me. I struggled with depression for many years and had therapy and antidepressants, and, you know, we're talking like 15 or 20 years ago. And it was really critical for me to grow and to be able to basically find a kind of base for how it would be in the world, you know, beyond the things that I experienced in childhood, and to make sense of it, you know. I was wondering what you said something earlier about ego, and you know, I'm curious as to your thoughts about how we relate to our egos, because we all have them, and you know, we have to find a balance with everyone else, and what has your journey been with your own sense of self and how you should be in the world, you know, to do good. I think that's my question.
Well, I just wanted to say, you know, I remember I went backpacking one time and there was a guide and I told my story and I remember she pulled me to the side and she was sort of like, well, that's, you know, that's the past. That's your story. You know, it was kind of like, oh, I grew up. My parents got divorced. It was really hard for me. And she was sort of like, that was years ago. How are you still hung up on that? And I was sort of like, well, it's basically like the foundation that built me, you know? So, and I thought what she had to say was sort of like, don't like keep like getting hung up on this. But at the same time, I didn't feel like it was, she was a little bit too dismissive for me. Yeah, with ego, I think that it's really helpful to remind myself, specifically in situations where there's conflict, maybe, like with, say, well, I guess in within family or within work, a lot of whenever I'm upset because of something, it's usually regarding ego, right? Like even like, let's say at work, like for example, the other day, I felt like somebody like dumped a whole bunch of work on me. And it's sort of like an ego thing, right? Because it's like, I'm like, wait a minute, why are you making me do everything? Why don't we like share? But it doesn't, I have the time to work on it, right? So it's more of an ego thing as in like, what, there's no equality, right? But if that wasn't an issue, I have the time to work on it. So why am I getting so upset about it, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I think similarly with maybe with family, I guess just realizing that everyone is having a different experience. So like I'm in my own little world of like, you know, getting distracted by things and you will call a family member and just realizing that, you know, they had an entirely different day. And so you maybe hit them with some information and maybe they don't respond in the way that you want them to. Just understanding that, just not having that be a problem, like just okay, like I mean, it's funny because I think for a long time, you know, we would talk about acceptance and I never really could like, well, okay, can you teach me how to let things go or can you teach me how to accept things? And there was never that, you know. And I thought maybe you just got to kind of like wait for that to, through meditation, that eventually is going to happen.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Travis and Columbine. So go ahead, Brenda.
Oh, you're on mute.
I got it.
There you go.
Okay,
there we go. So thank you very much, Columbine. That was a beautiful talk. And so you've been, you know, through so many different levels of experience. It was very helpful to listen. A lot to teach people, I think. My question's a little bit similar, I think, in some ways to the question that Travis answered, maybe from a slightly different angle, which is, I was intrigued by your comment about, you know, the self-worth versus ego. Because often I think, especially in religious organizations, you know, women are often kind of, they're called on to, you know, give up your ego and just do things for the religious organization, don't have a sense of self, or at work. And sometimes that means that they can also be taken advantage of in some ways, like you mentioned, somebody giving you a lot of work, which maybe they were capable of doing, but that they're choosing not to do, just putting it on you. So it's clearly a fine line. And you alluded to that a little bit, and yet we each have our egos that we also need to transcend, you know, and kind of having a healthy balance between, you know, self-care and, you know, and sort of being gathering a lot, you know, around the self or something like that. So I was intrigued by how you made a very clear distinction between, you said, self-worth, having a good sense of self-worth versus ego, and kind of how would you, how do you feel about it now? What do you think?
Well, like in this situation where the team member who was a male decided to kind of put it on me, I kind of took a sort of a, what's the word, like an unbiased stance. I was just like, well, you know, we're a team of three people, so let's just split the work three ways and do that. Like, I guess if it had been more of an ego, I could have been like, no, you do it. I don't want to do it. But yeah, I mean, it's challenging in work because, yeah, he does. We all have different roles and he does things that I don't do. And so therefore, I am theoretically going to be doing things that he isn't going to be doing. And if there's a situation where he actually doesn't have time and I need to take it on, that's fine. But yeah, I mean, I think so I think the balance that I struck was to say, let's just split it evenly. I don't know. But yeah, it's challenging. I mean, I think self-worth is like a self-respect. And ego is more where you get into this anger, like, this is unfair, I should be treated better kind of thing. Whereas like a respect is sort of, or a self-worth is more of like, I love myself and I think that we're three capable people that all have time and we all have skills and we should all do this together. And if somebody is really busy, then somebody else can help out. But in that next situation, yeah, it's hard as a woman. Yes, there's a lot of sexism.
Thank you. You answered that wonderfully.
Okay.
Thanks, Columbine. I think a lot of us can relate in Silicon Valley. So,
Yeah.
Okay, next we're going to take Teresa and then Giuseppe. Go ahead, Teresa.
Hi, Columbine.
Hi, Teresa.
How are you?
Good. How are you? It's early.
Yeah, early, 6 a.m. Thank you very much for your talk. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, I met you on a Wednesday night at Canon Do, and we didn't talk much at the beginning. I used to think that you always ask wonderful questions on Wednesday evenings. So I remember one Wednesday night you asked Fong, who came to give a talk, you asked her, why do you think silence is so intimate? And I thought that was such a wonderful question. Tonight, you talk about how you enjoy sitting with others without talking, how you find so much value on that, and how you find an intimacy that you haven't found even with people who were very close to you, like partners. So I wonder if you have further reflected on that and you have your own thoughts about how silence is so intimate. Thank you.
Mm. Who gave the talk?
Fuong.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You know, my dad always says that it's very intimate, I think, at least, that there is some intimacy with being with people Yeah, I think in a group setting, let's say you went to a party and, you know, you're making small talk. Sometimes the small talk is just a way to kind of hide or yeah, it's a, like a distraction kind of, like you talk about something really quickly with people and you're not really, you know, looking at them or understanding them. We do this a lot of times at work, you know, you'll see your colleague and you'll be like, oh, hey, how was your weekend, blah, blah, blah. And it's sort of this like neither here nor there interaction. And I think it can leave us feeling pretty empty. You know, I think it's challenging at work because you want to be professional and you're also working with people that you don't choose to necessarily work with. So a lot of times you don't necessarily line up your or say political beliefs or religious beliefs or just ethical beliefs. And so it's hard to be kind of intimate with work people, but I find that really challenging because we spend so much time with the people we work with. And so we're basically with these people that we're not really able to be intimate with for like basically our entire lives, probably more than our family members. And I think that can leave us with a feeling of sort of emptiness, maybe. So I think having the Sangha and having a spiritual practice can fill some of that.
Thanks, Columbine.
You know, I really like what Dave said once. He said that sitting with others, like sitting helps us to stop our chattering, our mental chattering. And he said, Dave, you can correct me if I don't quote you right, but he said something like, you know, sitting with others together in Seishin, it quiets down our collective mental chattering and it brings us together to a deeper level. We are all together in that deeper level. So
certainly can't correct that. You have it exactly on the nose.
Okay, I really like that, what you said about that, Dave. Thank you.
And I think that also, like when, like I said, like when I go hiking, I'm with other people. And I think there's like this weird like social construct of like, you know, if a group of people go hiking, they're like, they're the group and then there's you, but it's a weird like social agreement because I mean you're all physically in the same space and so you're actually all together, and that's one thing I enjoy is to be able to be with people. You know, I see people a lot and they want to talk and I like to say hi because it's nice, but then sometimes it goes on for a long time and then there is something nice in just like, you know, acknowledging each other, just saying, hey, you know, because you see them every day. And yeah.
Thanks. Next, we have Giuseppe and then Nili.
Hi, Columbine.
Hello. Your house is very beautiful.
Thank you. It's a nice outside. It's nice. Mm. Thank you for your talk. I think you spoke very well the Dharma to me. So I want to ask you to say a few words on what would be your advice on in your experience what works to keep our practice and also to stay away from those bad spots in which somehow we all tend to go back to fall into sometimes. So yes, that's my and not over the years, so to speak. Yeah, in a big picture. And I know that you said you have parents that have been practicing Buddhist since you were a child, so it means for a long time. So that's quite amazing. And so also how you relate to that.
How I relate to their practice?
To their practice over such a long time, and how they how you advise people, would you advise people to stay away from falling away from practice? You know, maybe some, it happens a lot in the Sangha that someone comes for a month, or comes for a year, or comes for 10 years, and then it disappears. So it disappears. So what's your, what are your thoughts about that?
For me, you know, I think it is nice to establish friendships in the Sangha, because if, let's say, you kind of lose the motivation to come, you know, somebody might message you and say, hey, where have you been? Like, I miss seeing you. So there's a sense of kind of being wanted, which I know is not really ideal, you know, because that is part of the ego of feeling like you need to be wanted. But I think that's sort of a natural human desire, maybe. Maybe it's not for everyone. Yeah, I felt that in the past, like, where I felt like, oh, well, nobody's going to notice if I don't come, you know. But then if somebody says, oh, I haven't seen you in a while, that can make you feel more wanting to come back. I mean, I think especially with Les, because he's so consistent, you know that, you know, he comes every day, every Wednesday, giving lectures, that for me was really helpful, because like I said, like, as a child there was a lot of change, and so to have that stability, you know, like, even I joined Wake Up, and it was like, it was a very small group. The meeting time was always changing, the location was always changing, and ultimately the group, all the members basically moved away. So it wasn't consistent at all. So yeah, that I haven't really continued with. And in terms of my parents, like, it's a really cool way to connect with my dad. You know, he started to go back to BZC, and we really have some great conversations. You know, like, he was helping me with writing, and he was asking questions about, like, boredom, and it was something we could kind of explore together. Yeah, that was really cool to be able to talk about as an adult, because, you know, as a child, I don't think I really understood a lot of things. My dad and my stepmom are more like Soto Zen. My mom, for a pretty long time, she's been more into Tibetan Buddhism. And like, she sits three times a day. And actually I don't know as much about the philosophy and just her practice in general. But I do feel like Soto Zen resonates strongly for me. I don't know if I answered your question. So yeah,
you did.
Okay,
you
cool.
Did. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have Neely.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for your talk. It was really helpful.
Oh, thank you.
I'm really curious, because you mentioned that at certain point you made the decision of getting away of a toxic job and changing your career to a less fulfilling job, but you are prioritizing yourself. So I'm wondering if there was a certain situation that made you make that change, and how do you feel lately about it?
That's a very good question. I think a lot of people in the Sangha, actually, I think Dan's talked about this too, where, you know, he's gotten into a less stressful job. It wasn't my choice, to tell you the truth. At the original company I was at, I sort of hopped ship at a kind of a desperate moment, and I started I joined a startup, and that startup actually was acquired by the company that I left, and so there was kind of the writing on the wall was that they were going to basically learn what we had, learn our technology, and get rid of us basically. So it was time to look for a new job, yeah, I had like two offers, and it was pretty challenging to decide which one to go with. I had a kind of a feeling that the one I took was going to be, I just had a kind of a feeling from the manager that it was going to be, he was going to be really like gentle on me. And it's a more forgiving environment. There's a lot more women in that company. And actually, to tell you more details, so it's a company that sells engineering stuff from Japan. So a lot of the engineers are in Japan. So we're more sales, and that's why there's probably more women. And that's why it's a little less stimulating for me as an engineer, because I am not able to design as much as I would like to. But at the same time, in the past, when I was more responsible for doing more design, it was really stressful. And it felt like I was kind of carrying the weight of the world, which was a complete misunderstanding. Like, I think, you know, into any high tech company in the area, like you walk into, like, say, BB, which a majority of people haven't even heard of BD, right? But it's a big biotech company. And if you meet anyone, they're like, oh, you know, BD is everything. Like, the world is just BD, you know, that's it. And so I think people tend to get really, really like blinded by the one company that they're in. These things were not really my free will or choice. It was sort of just luck. I think you need to seize the opportunity when it can come up, and then that's all you can do.
Thank you. Thanks, Nili and Columbine. Last call for questions.
Well, while Lee is, you know, Lee was one of the first people I ever saw when I came to Canada. And I think I told her this, but I remember her, I really remember her smile. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is like, you know, walking into the most like loving, warm place ever. And Lee, I remember her smile. That was one of the very, very first people I ever saw at Canada. So yeah, that was cool. And actually, I remember that day, Scott taught me how to, he's like, oh yeah, let's go fold Oreoke. And I'm like, okay. So yeah, that was Scott was a first interaction as well.
Yeah, Leah and Uma, the couple of people I interacted with first too.
I just remember when you first came to Cannondale, that was what I wanted to say. I remember meeting you and thinking, oh, wow, I hope that she continues. Because, you know, as Giuseppe was saying, so many people, so many people come and then give it a try and then never come back again. But I was just so happy that you found your way in Cannondale and kept on coming. And look at you now, you gave away Seeking Mind talk. Good for you. And it was wonderful. Oh, I appreciate it. I appreciate you.
Yeah. I was just remembering also Columbine, the first time I met you. And I think you it wasn't the first time you came to Canada. It was just the first time we met each other and you were with your dad. And I thought how wonderful. How wonderful that the two of you came in together. And I felt a little jealous. I would love for my dad to come to Canada or to be able to go somewhere to share something like that with him. It seemed wonderful.
Yeah, it's really special. I'm very lucky.
Thank you. Thank you for your talk. Thank you for sharing so many details so sincerely.
All right. Well, thank you, Columbine, for a really heartfelt and personal talk.
Oh, I think my grandma is trying to say hi, but she's on mute. She's
Can you tell me her name? Is it Pam?
Oh, Pam. Pam Robinson.
Okay.
That's my grandma, so.
Hi, she's Pam.
Hi.
We can see her, but she doesn't know how to unmute herself. But
yeah, probably.
It's nice to meet you, Pam. Thank you for coming.
Is that better?
Oh, wow.
Technology solved.
Columbine, that was wonderful. Yeah. Thank you all very much for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming.
Very special to be here.
Oh,
thank you.
Grandmothers are very special.
They are.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canandoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.